Saxhog, Looplands, Senate File 1154. Senator Saxhog, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member. Today I'm presenting, as you said, Senate File 1154. This bill will increase the rate of payment to counties that have loop lands, also known as land utilization project land. This land is owned by the federal government, leased by the state, and managed for wildlife. The problem is that the PILT payment is substantially less than that paid to the WMAs. With me today is Todd Beckel, Commissioner of Lake of the Woods County, to give some brief testimony and answer any questions the committee might have.
Commissioner?
Good morning, Todd Beckel. Mr. Chair and members, we're here to request an increase in payment in the LUP. LUP lands, as he stated, were federal lands. There's about 81,700 acres between Lake of the Woods, Roseau, and Beltrami County. We came down 2 years ago and received an increase from like 37 cents up to 75 cents. But it's managed as wildlife management area, the biggest share of it. And on that land, we're receiving $3 plus inflation on that. It's just an inconsistency in how the payments are received.
Commissioners.
Yes, sir.
So
yes,
part of the loop lands is receiving the same payment as the WMAs are?
No, it's not, but part of...
Mr. Chair.
Part of the LUP lands are inside a WMA area, so it's managed that way. It has no access to it. Part of it's on the outside of the WMA, and that's kind of... It's just a management practice. 10 years ago, or 8 years ago, they redid the lease with the feds, and the management practices has changed since that time. It was managed more for forestry and recreation. Now it's managed as wildlife.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, this is federal land, and it's under a state lease. I'm wondering, is there any federal PILT that comes with it?
Commissioner Beckel.
Chairman and members, my understanding is no. We receive nothing from the federal government on this land.
Mr. Chairman, we probably should check
on Senator
that.
Buck, yes. Senator Saxhog, I think we better check and make sure that there is no federal payment in lieu that is being received on this. And so, Senator Saxhog, currently the 75 cents, is that moving along the same as the rest of the state forest payment in lieu is?
The inflationary?
Yes.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner?
Yes, it is, sir.
Yes. Well, Senator Saxhog, we'll take a look at what's going on with regard to the if there is any federal PILT, and we will lay this Senate File 1154 without objection over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Senator
Chair. Thank you, Mr.
Commissioner.
Chair. Members, the one
Senator Saxhog.
That I was going to have Commissioner Beckel comment on, and you're well aware of it, is the percentage of government lands in Lake of the Woods County.
Commissioner.
We're over 75%, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, it does make a huge difference to our budget.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Senator Beck.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Beckel, the proceeds on timber sales off this land get split how?
Right now it all goes, Mr. Chair and members, it all goes to the management of Norris Camp. It's a wildlife area. We don't split it right now. It all goes to the camp.
So does the state receive any of the proceeds off the sale of timber or gravel or anything off this land?
No, sir. It goes to that management.
Well, Commissioner, isn't the camp a state-operated camp, though?
Mr. Chairman, Paul Posier is here from the DNR. He could probably give a more definitive answer.
Mr. Posier.
Thank you, Paul. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Pojar from the Department of Natural Resources, And we've reviewed the bill that you have before you, and there's really two parts to it. One is an increase in the amount of payment from the 75 cents per acre that the county is currently receiving to $3 an acre. That's one part of it. The other part is the division or splitting of the what's referred to in here as the annual net proceeds received by the commissioner from timber sales. So that would be a second part of the change that's being requested. And my understanding of the agreement we have with the federal government to manage those lands is that any of the proceeds that are received from timber cutting, gravel sales, that type of thing, is to be invested in improvement of that LUP land. And so we don't receive money that goes to the general fund or anything like that. It's reinvested in the land. Things like managing burning of prairie lands, if there are any in there. This is mostly a timbered area. But any of the management that we do in that area comes from those proceeds. So if they were to be diverted in any way from what is required under the lease, we would be in violation of that lease.
And Mr. Pozar, if the payment is increased under Senate File 1154, would all of those dollars also go into the management of the lands?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
If the payment is increased from the 75 cents to $3 as Senate File 1154 is proposing, would that increase also all go into the management of the lands?
No, the increase would go to the county to be distributed in accordance with 477A.14. There's some sharing back with the townships in the area. But in, like, Lake of the Woods, I don't think you have any organized townships.
We do not.
So in Lake of the Woods County, at least, it would all go to the county.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pozar. Senator Box.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pozar, I don't understand how if the proceeds of the land are supposed to be spent back on the land, how we would give the county one half of the annual proceeds, and well, then it would be distributed to local units of government and schools. How does that meet the federal intent?
Mr. Pozar.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, well, I'm not sure how you would do it. There are no proceeds that the commissioner receives to give half to anybody. It's supposed to be spent on the land. This Minnesota Statutes 477A is funded from the general fund. And so I'm assuming if it's in this bill that you're supposed to do that, the half proceeds would come from the general fund.
And Mr. Pozar, then, so that is the included in the fiscal note that the department...
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, that's correct, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pozar. Are there questions, members?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should explain
Mr. Pozar.
There's some quizzical looks on the faces here. Calendar year 2007-2008 would be the first year that this payment would be made. The state impact is said to be $365, according to the note here. Of that, $278,000 is as a result of changing from 75 cents to $3 an acre. The remainder is about $86,000, and that would be half of the proceeds, half of the net proceeds that were associated with the land or the timber sales last year.
But
no, Senator Barker.
Mr. Chairman, my point is, and I think you agree with me, the state never got the proceeds so that we could distribute half of them back because it had to be spent locally. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Senator
Pozar.
Bach, that is my understanding of how that would work, yes.
And Mr. Posar, Senator Saxog, this bill could be drafted so that that half of the proceeds, the 75 cents, would have been distributed as it has been in the past, as opposed to being increased dollars coming out of the general fund and only take the increased money to the county. Am I understanding this correctly?
Mr. Chair, I guess I don't understand that.
Mr. Posar, could you help me a little bit? The 365, you've got 278,000. That's the increase that's going to the counties. And then you also have 86,000, which is half of the proceeds that we currently have that is going to land management that would also have to come from the general fund. We wouldn't necessarily have to do that second provision. We could leave that the way it is.
That would, Mr. Chairman, that would be my understanding. It's up to you what portion of the bill you want to include or not.
Okay, thank you.
Amendment. Do you want to do that now?
No.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, members? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll lay Senate File 1154 over for possible inclusion without objection. Thank you. Senator Olsen. Senator Olsen, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members.
Property Tax Division, sorry.
It's a pleasure for me to be here this morning, and also I'm learning to appreciate the institutional memory of this body. We were before you testifying on something, another bill for Taylor's Falls, Mr. Chairman, and you remembered Taylor's Falls being before you on the issue that we have today about the state park. And I appreciate the memory because you guys see so many bills. I was kind of astounded that you could remember that. But we are here today with, I have Mayor Mike Buchheit of Taylor's Falls, and he will testify. But in meeting with the DNR, one of the reasons that I'm so supportive of this is that Taylor's Falls is the only state park in the DNR system that allows technical climbing. And that's part of the issue here. So I will turn it over to the mayor to address our concerns.
Mayor Buchheit.
Mr. Chair, members, I really appreciate your time. I know that you're all very busy. And I am currently the mayor of Taylor's Falls. Taylor's Falls is a very small city, sits right on the scenic St. Croix River in the valley. And we're very fortunate we have a state park, and the state park is about 300 acres of property, and that property sits completely within the city limits of Taylor's Falls. Now, a large portion of that property actually sits right at the edge of the St. Croix River. Beautiful rock outcroppings. We have the world's largest potholes. We call them kettle holes, largest in the world. It attracts the state park several tourists. The tourists that come there, it's quite unique because the state park, the Interstate State Park, is open 6 to 7 months out of the year, depending upon the year. And in that period of time, we pass about 350,000 visitors through that state park. It's a beautiful area, but unfortunately with that it also attracts climbers, which is good, but unfortunately what goes up must come down, sometimes at a very rapid rate, and when that does happen, we average somewhere in the area of 6, 7, 8 rock falls per year. If we have a good year, we have one fall. If we have a bad year, we have probably 15 falls. Now, when that happens, what we do is the Taylor's Falls Fire Department responds to those rock falls. We have high-level rescue training, and we have the equipment so that we can respond to those rock falls. That was a decision that was made by our city probably over 20 years ago. Unfortunately, the equipment is very expensive, not only to buy, but to maintain, as the training is. Very expensive to maintain. If you can picture a volunteer firefighter rappelling down the side of a rock cliff, that's exactly what our firefighters can do. And now when they actually respond to the interstate park, they're the ones who are able to rappel down the rocks, lift the people up so that they can carry them over and put them in the ambulance that actually responds to our site. Unfortunately, the way it works right now, it's all provided at a charge of free to the state of Minnesota. And I wish that it was actually free from the city of Taylor's Falls, but if Fire trucks cost a lot of money. I just know because I had to buy one, was forced to buy one because our current pumper truck, number one, was in 2007 this year, 20 years old, and you're forced to retire them even though they have 16,000 miles on them. Fortunately, it becomes the number two pumper, but when you buy a number one pumper truck, you're looking at fire trucks that are about $300,000. We had to buy two. And so that adds to the cost of providing the response to the interstate park. And now I thought, well, maybe we'll have a very good year where we don't respond at all. But once again, unfortunately, it costs money to have the equipment sitting there. It costs money every year to send our responders to training so they can provide that high-level rescue. And again, I wish it was a free service, but every time I open the doors of our fire hall, we go, there's $1,000 spent because we have to send trucks out. We have to pay responders when they're going down there. And even though we have not been paid directly by contract by the state on a regular or frequent basis, it's something we've said it's the right thing for us to do morally. We refuse not to respond. We're there to save lives. We have to do that. We have actually received some payments in the past, and I've never really been able to figure out a true pattern for it. I've been told, well, we've received some grant dollars from the DNR. We've received a temporary increase in LGA. We've been told, look at doing PILT dollars. It's, in my opinion, one of those. I don't really care how the city gets compensated, and I'm not looking to make a profit. What I'm looking to do is break even. We want to be compensated for what it costs to be able to provide that service. And we have actually used the state's formula, which is called the COP formula. And it's when one government entity charges another government entity for services. We've used that formula and sat down, and when we took a serious look at what it costs to provide that service, we said, this is just going to break our city eventually. We cannot continue to provide a free service. It's unfair to not only the commercial properties who benefit from the tourists, but to the residents who actually pay that lion's share of property taxes who really don't receive the benefits from tourists being there. We unfortunately have a city that's a state highway. It's about four blocks long, and on our busy days, we're passing 15,000 cars a day through our city. So it does add to some congestion. But again, we will continue to respond regardless of what happens from the state, but I'm here to say this is where we are. I would like to break even on this, and I would like some support from the state of Minnesota. So with that, I do appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mayor Buchheit and Senator Olson. This Senate File 1548 is a local government aid request to help Taylor's Falls offset the costs that they have because they have the state park wholly within their city boundaries. And
that is correct, and the mayor didn't mention the boat too. A lot of times when somebody falls and they do the rescue, they go down to the river and they launch a boat and take them. They put them on the boat, bring them to the landing, and meet the ambulance at the boat landing. So that maintaining the boat is another one of their costs too.
Thank you. Questions, members?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Senjum.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sitting here thinking if this was secondhand smoke, we'd close it, so to speak. Is this something that's just inherently unsafe? And you know, I'm a risk taker. I'm not suggesting we should close it, but you say 6, 7, 8 falls a year, and probably a few of those are deaths, or maybe one or two over the course of several years.
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct that we will have on occasion a fall that will cause a death. Mm-hmm. At one time, we would say we're going to have 12 rock falls this year and probably one death because of it. Unfortunately, it isn't just the rock climbers who are falling. It's oftentimes people who are visitors that are strolling along the paths and they're looking up at the rock climbers, kind of observing, and they'll walk off the path. And sometimes they'll fall down into a kettle hole, which are safety protected, but they'll fall off the edge of the rocks. Sometimes they'll fall off the edge of the rocks and land in the river. And so it doesn't become just a rock fall, scrape them off the pavement. It's a rock fall, recover them from the river. We have actually dragged the river on numerous occasions for people who have unfortunately drowned in our river. And in some cases, they weren't rock climbing. They were just observing. They lost their footing while they were strolling around the scenic St. Croix River Valley.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and without objections, we will lay Senate File 1548 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Senator Olson and Mayor Buchheit.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time.
And Senator Olsen, you have Senate File 1044.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is a bill. I'm going to have Keith Carlson from Metropolitan Counties come up and kind of address. He drafted the bill, so he knows it better than I. But as a locally elected official for 14 years, I've sat through a lot of truth and taxation hearings. And many times we're lucky to have two people come out. And so the concern is, you know, what is really the exact cost for counties and school districts and local government to provide these? And this is what this study would look at. And I will turn it over to Mr. Carlson at this time.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I think it's probably no surprise to the members of the committee that there is a great deal of frustration under the current truth and taxation process for counties, school districts, cities, and the other affected local governments. First, the cost of the notices and their mailing is substantial, and one-third of that cost is split between the city, the county, and the school district. But what adds to that frustration is for those counties, school districts, and larger cities that are required to hold hearings, they're also required to publish an advertisement in the newspaper of general circulation above and beyond the cost which they usually incur for their legal notices of giving notice of when the hearing is provided, and then have the hearing itself and has Senator Olsen indicated, very few people turn out, and usually of those who turn out, most of them have valuation issues that aren't really appropriately addressed by the truth and taxation hearing. So what this bill is doing is asking for the Department of Revenue to survey the local governments in the state, identify the total cost for the administration of truth and taxation, and identify the number of participants at the hearings. Once we have that information, then we can give a more informed review of the program and see if it's appropriate to make any changes. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll end my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Carlson, I think a couple years ago we put some language in the statutes that if your levy increases below CPI or some state average or some factor that you don't have to hold the truth in taxation, has that been helpful?
Mr. Chairman, I can only speak on behalf of my members who have taken advantage of that. Several of them have been below that threshold, but generally they have nevertheless opted to go forward and have the hearing, but in some instance they have skipped the advertisement in that case since they were not required to hold the hearing. So they have been able to save some cost under that provision. But there's still, so yes, you know, we appreciate that the legislature made that change and at least gave us the option of not having the hearing and or foregoing the advertising cost. But there's still substantial issues or concerns out there as to whether the at least the hearing part of it is really meeting the true objectives of the legislature when it passed this law, and whether there might be some alternatives that can be looked at.
And Mr. Carlson, there excuse me, are times when these hearings are fairly well attended. I think Senator Wergen was in front of the division earlier this year with some of her school representatives. They're a maximum effort capital loan school, and their truth and taxation hearings are very well attended because of the increases that they've been experiencing. I guess you're really not addressing the importance of it. You just would like to know what the costs are. Am I correct in that, Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members, yeah, we are not proposing on making any changes in the law at this time. This is just to identify what the costs are and what the participation are at the local levels. And then, again, when we have that information in hand, we can have a discussion as to what, if any, changes might be appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions, members? Oh. Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think this is a reasonable request. I mean, this clearly is a state mandate that we ask local units of government to carry out, and would only be fair for us to, I think, know what it's costing and what degree of participation we're getting. The other part I would like to know is that how many of these things do governing bodies say the legislature made me do it?
Mr. Carlson, you have a response to Senator Bach's question?
Mr. Chairman, I can't tell you with any certainty how often that comes up. I acknowledge that from time to time that finger-pointing does occur.
Anything else? Mr. Chairman, it does create a good venue for a local unit of government to do that. I guess if I was a locally elected official, I'd probably do the same thing.
Without objection,
Senator
Senjum.
Senator Skoy and Senator Osteen are the witness. Is this a study that will look forward and basically survey the experience in 2007, or would we be asking them to look back and tell us what, say, 2006, et cetera, was about? It's not clear, at least to me, in the bill. In other words, are we surveying 1 year, and is it going to be this year in anticipation for the January 15th report?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would anticipate that this is with regards to the 2007 truth and taxation process, that it's that 1 year's worth of experience that for which the cost would be collected and the participation would be identified.
Mr. Chair, and to the witness, is it important that it says that in the statute? I don't see it, but I may be missing it.
I don't know if the department has any thoughts about how they would do this.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bach.
I think if we're going to ask the department to contact all of these local units of government and request some information from them, it might not cost a lot of extra money to survey 2 years rather than just one and see just to have a little more information.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jason Nord. I work in the Property Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. I think when we looked at this initially, we thought that we would do it in connection with the 2007 Truth and Taxation hearings. People would have their information available. I don't know if people are tracking attendance or would be able to tell you what their attendance was for last year, but certainly I think we'd be open to including in a survey asking them what their 2006 experience was as well.
And Mr. Knorr, I would imagine that most jurisdictions, and when I was part of these as a locally elected official, we had sign-in sheets and we tracked, you know, who came and how many people participated. So perhaps you could head that way.
Yeah, we can do it right.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Without objection, we will lay Senate File 1044 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. And you're right. As a local government official, the legislature is a big target, of which I now am one. So thanks.
Senator Clark. Welcome to the committee, Senator Clark.
Good morning. Thanks for having us. I've got a couple handouts, too, for you all, if we can have those passed out. Well, we're here today on something that reinforces a key priority, I think, for everyone in the Senate this year, and that is in part the high commitment that we have as Minnesotans to make sure that regardless of where you live in Minnesota, that you can have a viable community, that you can at least be offering basic services. And obviously that's part of the reason why we're looking at local government aid and permanent property tax relief. And as we're looking at that over the rest of this session, we've found what we think is a glitch, a gap, that we're pretty concerned about. The city of Rockville, which is in District 15, is a community of just over 2,600 people. It's about 36 square miles, so it's a very large landmass, and they have consolidated. It used to be two townships in a city. In 2002, they've done a lot of efficiencies. They've done many important things to be very responsive to their local citizens. But part of what's happened is as the changes have happened in LGA, as the school taxes, as the county taxes have gone up, is that the burden that is on local residents has become very high. And we're concerned as we're moving forward that without some additional assistance, that it's going to be a challenge for the community to remain viable. So we're seeking today city-based increase. And there is an amendment, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you want that now or later, just to kind of narrowly clarify specifically the year in which the boundaries would have been formed. But otherwise, I've got Mayor Brian Herberg here to speak about the issue that is there, and Julie Zimmerman can take questions, who's their finance director.
And Senator Clark, there is the A1 amendment, and it's an amendment. Do you
yes,
have the A1?
We would prefer to go ahead and have that put on the bill. It changes on page 3, lines 6.7 and 6.8 from 2007 to 2006.
It brings the dates in line with what information we currently have with
Correct.
Regard to the boundaries.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And so Senator Bach moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. And so we're Mayor Herberg.
Yes, thank you. My name is Brian Herberg. I'm the mayor of the city of Rockville, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing us this morning. As Senator Clark had stated, back in 2002, the city of Rockville, the city of Pleasant Lake, and the Rockville Township had merged, primarily on focuses of streamlining government and the operation of our local community. And during that process, we had compiled a merger agreement, which all three entities agreed upon, and we've been following through with those very, very closely until more recently, when one of our projections that has been falling short, and that's the cut of our LGA. And with that being said, is made us put a financial increase on taxes in our local community, and our residents are kind of getting to the point where they're saying enough is enough. And in this past year, we have had to significantly cut back in our budget to help it get in line. And by doing that, we haven't cut any services to this point, but we have cut things from our budget that we were putting away, the things that we need to purchase in the future to maintain what we're providing. So those needs that were wants currently are very close to being their needs in the very near future and are unable to obtain those. So that is the reason for coming here today asking for your help is replenishing our LGA shortfall, which was presented in the handout in front of you.
Thank you, Mayor Herberg. And Mrs. Zimmerman with us also today?
Yes, hi. Thank you. Yes, my name is Julie Zimmerman, Mr. Chair and Senator Committee members. And I reiterate what both Senator Clark and Mayor Herberg have said. The $140,000 shortfall that we experienced is about 20% of our general fund levy each year. So that's a fairly significant cut for our city. We have a snowplow that's just barely getting by, and we're looking at having to keep that for another couple years just because of the cuts we've experienced. So we would greatly and respectfully ask for your thoughts in regard to this bill as far as helping the city stabilize itself. We're a growing city because of this consolidation, and we have some needs that this bill could help us with.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
I think one of the things that's also important to be pointing out is the belief is that over time, Rockville will grow enough sufficiently to be able to deal with this challenge, but it's going to take a while. Highway 23 was redirected through the town. There's been some significant issues with sewer and water that have had to be addressed.
And I think just to reinforce kind of what the challenge is the mayor and the city council are facing is the Recorey School District has failed three times in a row for a capital bond, and it's because people are just feeling like they're just so pushed. And if you look at some of the what's happened over time with the cuts, the city of Rockville actually has been disproportionately impacted.
And Senator Clark, do you have a thought on the time frame for that growth? Is there
we're anticipating about 10 years.
10 years.
So, Mr. Chair, you certainly could modify it to go within that time frame.
Okay. And Senator Clark, or maybe to the mayor, let me understand exactly what's going on. You consolidated two cities in one township. And as part of that consolidation, the formula for local government aid showed you having a $140,000 decrease from what you had been experiencing before the consolidation?
Mr. Chair, I believe our forecasts were including or anticipating the total of $205,867 for local government aid, and right now, as of 2007, we are receiving $62,000. One of the other things I think that I need to reiterate or elaborate, excuse me, is during this merger, the two lake areas, which Pleasant Lake was one of the or was the other city, is we incorporated a sewer around both of those lakes. And for the environmental issues that both lakes have seen very significant health issues as far as being beneficial to the lake area in the past 2 years since this has been online. And that was a almost $9.3 million project that we took on. So we've been following through with our merger agreement. It's just that we are now finding those financial straps that we're trying to deal with.
When did the consolidation take place?
I believe the official date was June of 2002.
Okay.
And Senator Clark, what we've been seeing as we've been working through the local government aid formula, particularly the local government aid formula, is a number of communities experiencing this very issue, that the formula is not truly representing the needs of individual cities. And so we are struggling with this as an issue. We will certainly take a look at Rockford's particular case here. And I guess what I'm gathering is that the consolidation is in here just to identify this as one particular jurisdiction.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I think, there was a lot of good reasons for the merger, and they are going to, in the long run, have some real efficiencies. But it has been a real challenge on the tax base. And as you are looking at a broader change in the formula, it may be that you're able to address the issues that Rockville is facing. Having said that, a number of the proposals that I've seen would still have a glitch, a gap, a pretty significant one for this community, which is why we're bringing this forward. So if you could just, as you're looking at it, take that into account as you're making your decisions.
And maybe to the mayor or Senator Clark, just so I get my geography right, where is Rockville?
Rockville is west of St. Cloud on the corridor of Highway 23, and the Interstate 94 just clips the northwest corner. If you look at this map that was presented to you, up in this left-hand corner is the corner of Interstate 94. And Highway 23 comes through from the north and goes out through the west.
And so, Mr. Chair, if you're going west out of St. Cloud, you would go through Rockville before you get to Cold Spring on your way to Wilmer. So it's connected, but it is a pretty rural part of our district. If you look on the map, you can see that a lot of it is still fairly agricultural based, which obviously is a problem with the tax base.
Senator Clark, you wouldn't. Consider this part of the St. Cloud Regional Center, perhaps. It's a distinct community outside of the St. Cloud.
When we think of our region locally, we would certainly consider them to be part of it, but when you look at what their needs and issues are, they are definitely distinct. their needs for LGA are very different than what the needs are in St. Cloud, for example. And frankly, part of the reason why this is a distinct community is because it has different needs. It is not the same place.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Clark, and just a comment. The cities of Norwood and Young America combined just before I was elected to the county board in 2000, and there was definitely some pain associated with that consolidation. Since then, it's been a good thing for the cities of Norwood and Young America, but there was definitely some transitional cost in the combination of their city governments. And I'm not sure whether we can make these adjustments or not, but I think that in the long run, it's probably the best thing for the cities, and I hope that you would agree with me that consolidation, regardless of this financial need this year, was a good decision for the residents of the communities.
I would agree with you.
Mayor.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator
Ortman, I think in the long run it will be, as long as the community can be viable. But part of the reason why I brought this forward, I agreed to work with them, is that they have been going through probably some unusually challenging growth pains as a part of, and just with the consolidation. And I think there were some expenses that may not have been all the way anticipated, in part because it was not a belief that the LGA would be reduced. If the LGA had stayed at the same rate, consolidation made perfect sense, and that's what people were thinking in 2002. The changes in 2003 that were made, frankly, put an additional burden on them, and they may have come up with a different decision or waited to consolidate. I mean, I can say from a regional standpoint, and Mr. Chair, when I say I think central Minnesota thinks of itself as a region, which is a little different than the St. Cloud area itself. But when you look at it, where the growth is going, there will be the growth here. But the environmental needs that they had, the water-related needs, they're pretty significant. And to have taken that much of a hit in the LGA cuts, it was not anticipated at the time of the merger, at the time of the consolidation.
Thank you very much,
you.
Senator Ortman. And without objection, we will lay Senate File 1372 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Senator Dill, Senate File 807. Welcome to the committee, Senator Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And members, the revenue estimate doesn't have the Senate file number on it, but it's House File 142.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 807 is another idea on how to help veterans and military personnel out. And the bill before you, if you'll look at it, you'll see that it's a section of law that defines how property tax and renters credit, renters rebates are calculated. And on page one of the bill, line 1.9, there's a definition of what income is included in this calculation. And then on page two, this is existing law that I'm referencing, there's on line 2.25, there's a section that starts income that is not included in this calculation. And then over on page three is the new language under, starting at 3.4, item three there, there's a list of things which may be subtracted from income when you're calculating your income for renters, property tax rebates, or homeowners property tax rebates. And the new language is on 3.13, as you can see. If a claimant is a military veteran as defined in section 197.447 and has been determined by the United States Veterans Administration to have a service-connected disability, the amount of payments to the claimant from the United States Veterans Administration under Title 38, United States Code Part 2, Chapter 11. So that sum of money that you're getting for your disability can be subtracted from your income. Now, on the fiscal note, you'll see that this does cost about $10.5 million a year. And the calculation is based on an estimated 53,000 veterans in Minnesota with a service-connected disability, and it's estimated that 40,000 of those 53,000 veterans will be able to take advantage of this, increasing their, on average, their property tax increase would be about $250. So that times 40,000 gives you the roughly $10.5 million annual cost. So it's another idea that's out there that I agreed to present before the committee for their consideration. And I know there's a long list of things to try to help veterans and other military personnel out, and this is another idea that I wanted to put on the table.
Oh, very good, Senator Dill, and appreciate it. Questions, members? Senator Dill, so we would be proposing to allow these disabled veterans to subtract their disability income of their income, you know, for calculating the property tax refund.
Right, and renter's refund. Yeah.
Anything else, members? Well, thank you, Senator Dill, for bringing this forward. We will certainly consider this as we are considering our efforts for providing some support to our veterans who have served us so well. With that, without objection, we will lay Senate File 807 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thanks, Senator Dill.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebretson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the Property Tax Division, Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill. We're here today, Mr. Chair and members, with regards to Senate File 1594. And basically what it is a relating to taxes, obviously. But it's in regards to our resorts in Minnesota. Minnesota, in 1973, there were over 3,600 resorts. And the count right now in 2006 is right around 900 resorts left. We all know what this particular business means to the state of Minnesota, and it has been a long-lived tradition for families coming to our communities for years. And we would like to change the we're here today to ask the committee to change the rate of the Tier 1 tax homestead credit. And the revenue analysis detail is that the proposal was simulated on a payable, this proposal simulated on proposal 2007 property tax model. Property taxes on Class 1C homestead resorts would decrease 6% under this proposal. The classification change would result in property taxes being shifted from Class 1C property to other property included homesteads. As a result, property tax refunds would increase by would increase by $20,000 annually. I have with me today is Joel Carlson and Tom Ossell from the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. He's also a resort owner, and I'll let them testify.
Mr. Ossell.
My name is Tom Ossell, and we have a resort on Lake Cabotogama in beautiful Voyageurs National Park. We have a small 10-cabin resort. I went back and looked at my tax valuations since 2000, and they were going up, you know, small amount, you know, or sometimes 20% a year, but last year was a huge increase. Last year, my valuation was, we're just a small resort, but it went from $658,000 in 07. It's almost 1.2, so it almost doubled. When we got the tax relief in 05 for the first $500,000, that saved us some money. And I think I and most other resorts took that money, just put it back into our resort. We just made our cabins nicer. As we make our cabins nicer, we raise our rates and we get more sales tax. So since 2000, you know, I pay three times as much in sales tax as I now as I did in 2000. So the relief is very, very important for us to stay in business.
Mr. O'Sell, we certainly understand the importance of the resorts to Minnesota. You did mention the change that was made a couple years ago, and now what your point is that the valuations have increased so that you've lost that gain
that you made.
Well, I'll think about this, but one of the things that occurs to me is we had a comparable issue on the ag land, and what we did is put an inflation factor valuation so that the values would kind of track along with the value of the real estate. But I guess I'll think about that. And Senator Ingebretson, you're here with Mr. Carlson?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman and members, Joel Carlson on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, and we appreciate the effort that this committee has made to look at the resort property tax issue, and the change that you made, Senator Scoia, in 2005 did help significantly. We did not index that provision at that time, and I remember sitting in this room at this very table when you struck that deal, and that was about all we were going to get out of Representative Abrams at that time. I think the ag property now is at about $900,000, and it's indexed into the future years, and we'd certainly welcome any relief in that regard. We've had a number of people who have just felt that the effort that we made in 2005 has been kind of eaten up, and in talking with the Department of Revenue and others, they feel that the best way to address the resort tax issue is through adjusting the tiers and not through not going to some alternative form of valuation like a Green Acres program that we discussed at one point. So we appreciate your help and support and considering this issue. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson, I think you're right. We'll work within the tier structure and not revisit the valuation mechanism. Questions, members?
Just a comment. You know, if from where I live, you have to drive 2.5 to 3 hours to even find a resort, and so, you know, these things are important to a lot of our citizens from the standpoint of family vacations and so on and so forth. I'd like to see us help them if we can, and it's important industry in Minnesota, and it's important to a lot of folks that don't otherwise have access to a lake, and that's a special week.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you, and Senator Senjum, you're absolutely right. For people of more modest means, these 1C resorts are how they have access to our state's, one of our state's great resources, our lakes. So with that, we will lay Senate File 1594 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Senator Ingebretson. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're running out of senators, huh? Senator Chaudhry is on his way down, members, so we'll be doing Senate File 1420 next. Through all of these. put a shot in there. Is Mr. May here? Partners or somebody on this? We certainly can move you ahead, Senator Scogin. This is perfect. We've been waiting for senators. We will go to Senate File 1227, Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Senator Scogin.
Before we start, I'd like to make an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, to fill in some of the blank lines that you might see in the bill that you have before you, Senate File 1227.
Senator Larson moves the A1 amendment, and this is to get the bill in the order that you would like, Senator Scogin, and fill in the appropriational lines.
That's correct.
I'm believing. So with that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
Thank you. Senate File 1227 deals with something that was on everybody's lips, committee, during the past campaign. When we'd go door knocking, property taxes was one of the key issues that we talked about with our constituents. And I think the message was heard statewide. Today I will help present a Property Tax Relief Act that the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities has presented to me. It attempts to offer something for everyone. I guess when we talk about property tax relief, one of the big questions is, what's in it for us? Well, in this legislation, you'll find it provides some permanent property tax relief to all levels of local government and different regions of the state. You'll find that it attacks property tax increases at their sources. I think you'll find that it provides the right aid to the right areas of the state, including LGA, school equalization, and county aid. And I think, too, Senators, that you'll find it creates a balanced property tax relief bill that provides relief evenly to Greater Minnesota and the metro areas by addressing one of the primary causes of property tax increases, reductions in state aid. From the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities with me today is Steve Peterson, and he will help us present Senate File 1227.
Thank you, Senator Scogin. Mr. Peterson.
Members, my name is Steve Peterson. I'm with Flaherty & Hood here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I'm going to start by just walking through the bill here and going over the parts of it briefly. The first sections, 1, 2, 3, and 4, deal with school equalization levies. It has three different levies. In one of the handouts in that is going past you guys now is an overall outline of the bill. The three different levies that we chose to equalize were the operating capital levy, which goes for things such as books, the $71 million there, $16 million in debt service equalization, and $88 million in the referendum levy equalization. What does that mean as far as the changes in the actual numbers? The one thing we did, too, and this is kind of an important point in looking at how we looked at this property tax relief, is we changed it, the school equalization levy, from just saying, for example, on the debt service, it was always a point of $3,200 of net tax capacity per pupil was the equalization level. Well, what has occurred is that number has been in there for the last 4 years, I believe, and what has occurred is property values went up and the equalization level stayed the same. So stuff that was originally designed for to be coming from aid then shifted over to levy. What this bill does is it changes that equalization level and the level for the debt operation and the referendum capital to a percentage of the state percentage of the total tax capacity per pupil unit. So everything is measured as a point of like 90% of the total tax capacity per pupil unit as opposed to a flat dollar amount. That way, when you go forward through the years, and property values go up, your equalization level will remain the same as opposed to just shifting from levy or from aid back over to levy if we just raised it one time. So that said, in the operating capital referendum, we raise it to 400% of the statewide average. So we take a lot on of that of the operating capital levy. On the debt service, we raise it to 90% of the state average, or raising the first tier to $5,900 per pupil unit. The referendum gets raised to, there's two tiers in the referendum, 135% and 100% of state average. I'm not an expert on school levies, but I will do my best to answer any questions you guys have on that portion of the bill. The idea was also that we could create a bill that not every city receives local government aid, and every city is in a school district, and every citizen is in a school district. And this is a way of reaching out and making sure that when we look at property taxes, we're looking at the broad base of it, of counties, aides, and school districts.
Mr. Peterson, yeah. You said on line 18 that the 90% was comparable to 5,900. Did you know what the 116% is equal to on line 124?
I do not have that in front of me.
Okay, thank you. We'll get that later.
Yeah. I do know for the operating capital, if you want those numbers, and the referendum.
Sure.
For the operating capital, the 400% of statewide is equal to $27,749. And for the referendum, the 135% is equal to $637,337. And the 100% is $472,102. And those are market value numbers.
Thank you.
The next section of the bill has to deal with local government aid. And I can't give you guys a handout there because I think it's handy when talking about the LGA formula that you actually see the formula in front of you. So there's one there with a definition, the formula for Fergus Falls, one of the Senator Scogan's good cities. And so I just want to go through the different things that we have in here. First of all, we are increasing the LGA formula to by $125 million in this bill. We have five formula modifications, which are outlined in that one handout. The first one, four of them have been in the tax bills in prior years. Let me just get my notes here because I'm all over the place. The first one being in this formula in Section 6 is the need inflation adjustment. When you look on that handout of the LGA formula, you have a base and you have a need minus your effort, and that's the bulk of the LGA formula. When they did this formula, they based the need off of the year 2000 city spending. That's how they made that long regression to figure out what goes in to the LGA formula. When they put the formula into place, they used the year 2003 effort. What we are doing is inflating the need so that we capture the growth in need from the year 2000 to 2003. Right now, we just inflate the need from 2003 and on because the dollars used to create that need formula was based in the year 2000. So we're just trying to make apples to apples here, if I stated that clearly enough. That was in the Senate bill the last 2 years. Secondly, we raised the next portion of the bill is the regional center aid base. We have the use of the current population in our regional center aid base. That has been in the Senate bill in the past. We removed the taconite aid offset. We increased the maximum aid caps from 10% to 35%. When we put more money into the formula, we like to raise the cap so that makes sure the money goes to where it's supposed to go to. We increase the LGA appropriation by inflation every year following this $125 million increase. And those are all formula modifications that the Senate has done in the past. The one new wrinkle to our LGA is found on, Section 10 of the bill. It's a supplemental aid. And if you look on your handout, this lovely graph here with the green and red bars kind of explains what this supplemental aid does. I had some time over the summer to kind of look at who's winning and losing in the LGA formula and property tax formula as far as revenues, ability to raise revenues. What I found is that the average city, with just its levy at the average tax rate, can generate $365 per person of revenue. I went and I looked, and you can kind of see the red portion of this bars for these cities are what a city can do if they just charge that average tax rate. So the city of Edina on the far right has a very strong tax base, obviously. At the average tax rate, they're going to generate a lot of revenue per person, and you can see that they do. Meanwhile, a city like Marshall on the other side, the red portion of there, is their levy only at the average tax rate, would only be generating roughly $2.25 per person. But after aid is applied, they receive sufficient aid that they are then able to generate more revenue than the average city per capita. What this formula or supplemental aid portion of this bill does is it brings a city like St. Joseph's or Brooklyn Park here, which after aid is applied, LGA is applied, are not able to generate what the average city can do with just their levy at the average tax rate. So what we're saying is after aid is applied, every city in the state should be able to generate the average amount of revenue at the average tax rate. And so that's what this little supplemental aid formula does. And it affects, you know, a handful of cities, and you can see in the run that I'll be passing out which one those are.
Mr. Peterson,
yep.
You were here when the city of Rockville was talking about their problems with the current formula and how the need wasn't being reflected in the LGA. It was their point. How does this city supplemental aid relate to the needs of communities? Do you have any connection that's being made there?
It looks basically at their tax base. It doesn't look at their need. It looks strictly at their tax base. So if they have a very low tax base and their need based on the other LGA, if they're not receiving LGA based on the other formula and they have a low tax base, we're going to bring them up so they're receiving some aid so they're at the average level. Now, I did look just because I was curious when you're talking about the city of Rockville. Rockville, I believe, and I won't misquote myself, I'll look it up here in 2 seconds, receives about $60,000. Rockford, is it Rockford or Rockville?
Ville.
Oh, Ville. Well, Rockford received $60,000.
Rockville's right below.
Right below. It did not receive anything underneath the supplemental aid. So.
Wouldn't receive anything?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
And finally in this bill, there is county aid, $25 million. This would return them to the levels that they were in 2003. It goes straight on to the current county aid formula split between the equalization and the need thing, just as it is today. And that is the essence of the bill.
And, Mr. Peterson, in the county aid formula, on the need side, you're leaving the ratio between the Part 1 crimes and the population, that stays the same also?
Correct. We made no changes as far as how the county aid is applied to the counties.
Okay, thank you. Questions, members? Well, Mr. Peterson, I know you said you weren't an expert on the equalized debt service levy. Our fiscal note here has costs that have not been determined here. Have you been able to make some estimates as to what the...
Mr. Chairman and Senators, we have actually have a run here of the school levies that we can hand out here, and it's $175 million is what the cost for these changes underneath the school aid is. So it's a comprehensive property tax relief plan that has $175 million in school levy reductions, $125 million in local government aid, and $25 million in county aid.
Do you have a split on that? $175 million between the differing formulas that you are adjusting here?
It's $71 million in the operating capital.
Oh, yeah, there it is. I see it.
Yep, okay. $88 million in the referendum and $16 million in debt service.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mm-hmm. Questions, members? Looks like a pretty all-encompassing program touching on all the aids that the state is paying out.
Mr. Chair and Committee, we also
Senator
have the
Scogin.
Estimated LGA runs. If you're interested in those, we can hand those out as well.
Sure.
And on the, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Members, Peterson,
on the LGA runs, it separates it from what they the estimated 2008 the estimated 2008 based on the formula changes that have been put in the past, and then also a secondary supplemental aid so you can see which cities are benefiting from that supplemental aid that has been included in this bill.
And, Mr. Peterson, when I look at this run, is the form the supplemental city aid that you added, is that just an additional aid? That isn't affecting any of the old money?
It is, Mr. Chairman, members. The supplemental aid is applied after the LGA is applied to the city, so it kind of looks at what they're receiving under the old formula, but it's all underneath the same appropriation. So if you did not include the supplemental aid there, and you still put $125 million in, there would be more money for those cities underneath the current form.
Okay, thank you. Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at this supplemental aid, and I'm curious if a city doesn't get any supplemental aid, or they're just not mentioned on here?
Mr. Chairman, members, no, they should be on there. We have it separated into our coalition cities, select metro cities, and then the rest of it. So if you're looking for a city that's it might be further in the back, are you looking for a particular city?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Artman.
I'm looking alphabetically down the list to see, but it's not alphabetical? No.
Yeah, it's the way that, Mr. Chairman, it's by
Mr. Peterson.
Senator Artman. The very first group is the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And if you go to the next page, it has some select metro cities, the one that people normally look at, and then the remainder of cities are after that in alphabetical order.
So Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, to follow a city, you'd have to look on three lists.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Peterson and Senator Artman, you would have to pick whether the city is an LGA or a metro city or then whatever the third category is, other, which I believe is mostly the smaller cities. Is that right, Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, correct.
Questions, members? Well, thank you, Senator Scogin. Certainly something that we're going to take a look at as we try to work through the LGA stuff. Anything else? With that, we will lay Senate File 1227 over without objection for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thanks, Steve.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you. This bill creates a new classification for 2C unimproved shoreland with a class rate of 0.6%. Most residential and seasonal recreational residential property is currently classified at 1%. The reason for this bill is so that we can reduce some of the developmental pressure on Minnesota's shorelands with a carrot as opposed to a stick. For those in greater Minnesota, the shoreland boom, development boom is self-evident in all of the homes and the starter castles that have been being erected all over the state of Minnesota, or particularly over the last decade. In the metro area, the going phrase is we better get some shoreland because they ain't making it anymore. And this has driven a tremendous housing boom along Minnesota's lakeshore. I'm not here to say that there's anything wrong with that. What I'm here to say is that we could stand to benefit by slowing down a bit, that there are environmental impacts of greater development along shorelands if we don't take a more measured look at it. So let's give people an incentive to not develop their own property and enjoy that shoreland in a different way, one that has less environmental impact and one that we could provide an incentive to do voluntarily. So to qualify for this Class 2C, a property under this bill must be unimproved, not agricultural, include 200 feet of shoreline within 400 feet of ordinary high water, can be homesteaded or in possession of the owner for 7 years. The owner under this bill would file an application with the county auditor for by July 1st for classification in the subsequent year, and a covenant agreement to not develop the land must be filed. So that's a summary of the bill, and with me is Jeff Forster with the Minnesota Seasonal Property Owners Association.
Senator Chaudhry, did you have a change that you would like made in the bill on page 4, line 11? I think currently this bill is addressing 200 contiguous feet of unimproved shoreline. And did you want to go to 400?
In discussions with the Department of Revenue, there was an agreement that we change that from 200 to 400.
Senator Ortman moves on page 4, line 11, that we delete 200 and insert 400. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Forster.
Chairman Scoia and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forster, and I am Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners. We are an association of seasonal property owners in the state, and on behalf of them, I would like to thank you for giving me time to testify here today, and thank Senator Chaudhry for authoring this bill. MSRPO and its members are strongly in favor of blue waters. I have included some letters from these folks to give you a flavor of the problems they have been facing recently. Blue waters would not only provide a partial solution for a few of these, but it would provide economic, biological, and aesthetic benefits to the state as well. The current property tax system encourages development, and blue waters is an attempt to have policy drive conservation and preservation instead of speculation and overdevelopment. We all value untrammeled lands. We all understand this truth intuitively. But what is the value in dollars of natural shoreline? This is a critical question. One of Minnesota's greatest resources is shoreline. We have over 90,000 miles of it, more than California, Florida, and Hawaii combined. About one-third of our lakeshore is in private ownership. A 1996 study in Maine concluded that a one-meter increase in lake water clarity resulted in increases in property prices ranging from $11 per front foot to $200 per front foot. A study in New York not long after had similar results. Three researchers from Wisconsin looked at land values in Wisconsin from 1997 to 2001 and found that, and I quote, "Restrictions on a lake based on its level of development and sensitivity to environmental change increased market value of shoreline property. People are willing to pay more to live on a lake that's protected from degradation," unquote, end quote. In 2003, Bemidji State and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency found that for each meter increase in water clarity, the value of a front foot of lakeshore rose by $423. A one-meter decrease, however, in water clarity cut values by $594. Overdevelopment of lakeshore is one of the main causes of loss of clarity on a lake. With over 90,000 miles of shoreline, the loss of tax base in the lakes districts due to overdevelopment is many billions. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency estimates that the cost of just beginning restoration of waters that are already impaired is over $3 billion. And every day that figure rises. There is simply no compelling economic reason not to support shoreline protection. Public opinion surveys conducted by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency show that Minnesotans rank surface water protection as their top environmental priority. But recent hysteria over eminent domain issues showed that many owners are concerned with the taking of property. Blue Waters avoids this pitfall while still achieving its environmental and economic goals with incentive rather than regulation. Is overdevelopment of lakeshore a problem in Minnesota? The answer is yes. There is no doubt that the rate that land is being sold, subdivided, and developed or redeveloped is accelerating. In 2005, the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources wrote, Minnesota's forests are used for timber production, recreation, wildlife habitat, and increasingly for home sites. Ownership of less than 20 acres is the fastest growing category. The size of a seasonal lot in Minnesota has been steadily declining in recent years, shrinking from an average of 79 acres to just 53 acres. Research gives us, we must ask, are people selling these places because they want to make a good return on their investment, or is some other force at work? And research gives us an answer. The average length of seasonal property ownership in Minnesota is 25 years. The national average is four, just 4 years. The average length of homestead ownership on a lake with lakeshore land is 15 years, almost twice the rate for homes elsewhere in the state. The demographic of lakeshore owners in Minnesota is a rare and special thing in this nation. Those in Minnesota who own lakeshore property have tended to hold it for long term. One of two factors is changing this trend, a jump in value or a jump in expenses. MSRPO in 2005 hired an independent researcher to find out which one it was. The results demonstrate that 86% of seasonal owners do not want to sell their property. 30% of that 86% want to leave the land to their children or grandchildren. Only 8% of seasonal owners originally bought their property as an investment. 2% sell their property expressly for profit. Seasonal property owners in Minnesota, by and large, see their land as an heirloom and not an asset. But here is the key fact that Blue Waters addresses. 6% of seasonal owners, almost 12,000 families, said that they may be forced to sell their property in the next 3 years because it is no longer affordable. The data is clear. In Minnesota, the average seasonal owner is not selling their property looking for a quick profit. They are selling because they cannot afford the taxes. The need is also clear. Recent efforts at passing and implementing more strident lakeshore regulations, which most cabin owners I've spoken with do support, have nonetheless met with strong enough opposition that they were only sporadically adopted, and implementation in areas that did adopt the new measures grant variances up at a rate of up to 80% of the time. Clearly, regulation alone will not reverse the disturbing trends we see on Minnesota's lakes. Incentive will. Minnesota Waters, the old Minnesota Lakes Association, endorses the concept. Groups as diverse as the Sierra Club and the Minnesota Taxpayers League have also endorsed Blue Waters. Political support could not be more broad. Science in multiple fields demonstrates clearly that there are strong wildlife benefits. Economists tell us there are net gains in tax base when we protect shoreline. And demographic studies show us that not only is pressure upon our lakes going to increase, population growth in the lake districts rivals that of the outer ring suburbs, but that many people who could and would protect lakeshore for the public benefit simply cannot afford to do so. So the question is, why has this bill been around for so long and not been passed? The devil has been in the details. How many feet of shoreline to qualify, how to frustrate the attempts of speculators who would use this legislation to benefit themselves, how to keep its implementation simple enough so as not to overburden already busy assessors. MSRPO and Senator Chaudhry are working with assessors, the DNR, and the Department of Revenue to address any concerns they may have. Providing incentive is both cheaper and is cheaper both politically and in its eventual administration. Tax shifts will be minimal, but the benefits to fish habitat and water quality are large and will be shared by all owners on the lake. According to the DNR, 75% of waterfront owners own less than 200 feet. The median is 130 feet. The vast majority of properties will not qualify. But as Paula West from Minnesota Waters makes clear in her recent email to the members of this committee, the few owners that do qualify and might use Blue Waters will provide a disproportionate benefit to the state. She states that as development pressure increases, areas that are less suitable and are increasingly being developed, low-lying areas, wetlands, and shoreline, even on small, shallow lakes, prime habitat. In short, time is running out for Minnesota's waters. Much work needs to be done. Blue Waters is not the only solution, but it will prove to be a valuable tool, and it is also the easiest to implement. This is the year to pass Blue Waters, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Forrester and Senator Chaudhry. You know, we are certainly sympathetic and concerned about the property tax impacts on seasonal recreation, as we are with all of the properties across the state. And, you know, we're going to take a pretty good run at shoving back on property taxes. One of the things that, when I look at the bill, Senator Chaudhry, you know, we've got these class rate changes, and when we see a class rate change, it does result in shifting within jurisdictions. And I know Mr. Forrester said that he thought it might be a minimal shift, but, you know, if we are going to achieve these benefits to the state, I'm a little hesitant to shift the cost of those benefits onto the folks that live in town when the primary benefits are going to be to the people that live around the lake. So I don't know where we'd want to go with that, but it looks to me like in the long term the mechanism to achieve your goals is probably not best achieved with a class rate change, but we'll take a look at it. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Forrester, I know this has been around a long time, and my hesitancy has always been the speculating issue. And, I mean, it was brought to mind again on Saturday when I got a call that a point on an island on Vermilion was now for sale, close to where I live. And I looked at that point when that island was subdivided about 15 years ago and actually gave some serious consideration to buying that point. And it was $26,000. And it's now listed 12 or 15 years later for $250,000. And it's going to sell. And I guess I'm a little concerned about kind of adding to that, making it even easier for people to speculate like that. Nothing's been built on it. They cleared it a little bit, put a picnic table in there and a little floor for a screenhouse. Never even actually put a dock out. And, I mean, good for them. They're going to make a real handsome profit. But is there some way, Mr. Forrester, that we can avoid this class rate change to be used that way?
Chairman Scully, Senator Bach. That's one of the reasons we're working with Department of Revenue, because that isn't the intention of the bill, but it seems like we're close, because if you had bought that point on Lake Vermilion, you would have had to hold it, I think, for 7 years before you could have enrolled. Then you enroll in before July of that year, and then you have to write a letter 8 years out saying you want to get it back out again. So you write your letter the day you enroll it, and you get the benefit for 8 years. And then you pull it out at the end, but you have to pay the back taxes for 7 years, the difference. So there's no gain, you know, except for the fact that it's wrapped up for 15 years. So if something happens, you get sick, there's a divorce, you know, and you got to sell the property immediately, then there, you know, would be no benefit, you know. I mean, that's how we're trying to address that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Forrester, my other kind of concern about it is, in recent time on the lake that we live on anyway, there have been some very, very large, I guess you'd call them cabins, built because they're not homesteaded. Most recently in Wakamup Bay, a very large one on an island with a lot of shoreline.
Right.
And I imagine property taxes on those places are, I just make a guess, they're paying $15,000, $20,000 a year for property taxes. But they have a large, people are going to invest multi-million dollars in a cabin like that, like to have a large piece of property. Are we now allowing them to be able to take the property adjacent to them that they own, that they have no plans of selling, because it's kind of part of this big cabin's character to have some undeveloped shoreline? Are we just reducing their property tax burden to allow them to have a larger piece with no neighbors?
Right.
Mr. Forrester.
Chairman Scully, Senator Bach. There's a mechanism for them, conservation easements. But people that are lower income, I mean, if you have income, you can get a conservation easement, and the federal government just sweetened the deal, doubling the benefit, the income tax benefit from a conservation easement for the next 2 years. But if you're retired and you don't have income, the income tax deduction does you no good. So you can't really use a conservation easement. And in fact, it even looks like it's getting more restrictive in the state, because there was a an idea to change the language, I think, dealing with conservation easement from assessors must change property tax values to may. So I can be low income, have all this land, and say, okay, I'll put it into a conservation easement. Doesn't change the value of my land. I still have huge property tax bills. I can't sell the land, and I can't take an income tax write-off. So the wealthy people have their benefit. If they want to preserve it, they have a conservation easement, you know, for these million-dollar cabins. It's the people like the letters that I gave to you that are really the ones who are being forced to sell, and this bill would help them. That's our goal.
Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, and following along the lines that Senator Bach has been going, I'm looking at page 4 of your bill, Senator Chaudhry, lines 4.19 through 4.21. And with the alternative in this bill, the property is qualified if it is the homestead of the owner or has been in the possession of the owner or son, daughter, spouse, whatever, for 7 years. That's a major concern to me because if it's not the homestead of the property, now we are shifting taxes to homesteaders for the benefit of those people who have a secondary property. And I don't think that's in the best interest of Minnesotans. If it were a homestead, I think you could make a better case. But as long as you're talking about people's second property, third property, fourth property, I don't think you can make a good case for shifting. If you can, I hope you will.
Mr. Forrester.
Senator Scoy and...
I think it's the environment is our best case.
Right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman.
Senator Chaudhry.
It's what I started out saying in my opening remarks. Now, whether you homestead it or not, whether it's a second home or your first home, we're going to run out of this stuff pretty soon. And not that I have any fundamental principle against developing your own property, but I think that it's in the interest of environmental impact that we help people make a different decision and not to develop it. So that crosses over from homesteading, just homesteading. It applies to everyone. And coming from someone who is in town, Mr. Chair, I don't mind. That shifts on to my my primary residential property. That's a way of funding an environmental program like we do in any number of ways in state government through our tax dollars. This one isn't done with the general fund. That's the only difference.
Well, Senator Chaudhry, the shift would be not onto somebody who lives in the metropolitan area, but onto the whoever lives in the small town or is living in the surrounding area of the lake. You know, the county,
Chairman.
City, and school property taxes would be shifting within the jurisdiction. Mr.
Chairman Stoyx, Senator Ortman. It does shift taxes, but it also shifts benefit in increased property values and also in aesthetic value. I mean, if a lake is a hot fishing lake, and the DNR tells us that much of this is dependent upon undeveloped shoreline. That's one of the key components in keeping a fishery. That benefit is going to be shared by everybody. Property values are going to go up around the lake. The cleaner the lake is and the less developed it is. And Senator Bach gave the great example on Lake Vermilion. That's where our place is, and we don't have a cabin. We have undeveloped land. But when somebody builds a huge cabin on the point, a huge house, that shifts onto me. My property values go up. That's the mechanism that this is trying to frustrate for people that would like to leave the land in a natural state.
Mr. Chair, do we have an
Senator
idea of the amount?
I was going to ask Mr. Hagan if he could come up and give us some information on the amount of shifting that would be going on.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bach,
can I clarify something Mr. Forrester said?
Yes.
When tax capacity increases, more cabins or homes get built, your market value might go up. But if the local levies are held constant, your taxes actually will go down. And we often get confused between rising market values and rising taxes. And you know, it is, if we let limited market value phase out, your taxes will go down, because there's about $700-800 million worth of property in your township that's not being taxed today.
Right.
Mr. Ford.
And that shouldn't cause your market value to go up, but it should cause your taxes in your township to go down.
Chairman Scoy and Senator Bach, I've heard this, and I understand it intellectually, but then I get my tax bill, and I look at the figures that show that cabins are paying a very low, what's the figure that they use, net tax, no, tax is a percentage value. But my tax bill went up 80% last year, and it's value-driven. My values are going up. I mean, that's the only, I mean, so I understand it intellectually, but it never seems to play out that way on my bill, and I'm confused by it. I understand the argument, though. And
Senator Ortman, then Mr.
Chair. And I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to live in that same jurisdiction in a little house that doesn't abut the water. But there's more and more development in the area. I'm a homesteader, but someone comes in from the Twin Cities is not a homesteader, builds the million-dollar property. My property values just went up, but I'm not on the water. My property taxes are likely to go up, but they're likely to go up even more because now you want us to shift the tax burden from the big development to me. And I'm trying to figure out why that's fair. I'm not hearing it. I'm not hearing that it's a good idea. And so I'm wondering, Senator Chaudhry, if you would still be supporting your bill if I took out and amended lines 4.19 through 4.21, and members of the committee, I'll offer this as an amendment to strike the word either in the Roman numeral 1 off of line 4.19, and then everything after the word owner on that same line. So it would read, the property is the homestead of the owner, semicolon, and then go on to line 4.
Senator Ortman, are you moving
that amendment? I am making that motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman has moved to strike everything after owner on page 4, line 19, basically to the semicolon, I believe. Let's hear from Mr. Hagan with regard to how much shifting would be going on with regard to the owners and also to the people that are not homestead, if you could help us, Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chairman, John Hagan with the Department of Revenue. That's a huge question I really can't appropriately answer. Certainly you are correct, there would be some shifting going on when you capture the value and give it a lower class rate. There is shifting. How much would depend on the what effect the 400 feet would be, how many properties would be affected. We have some concerns over some of the administrative details. Mr. Forrester spoke that the devil was in the details, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. At this time, we don't have a clear enough definition to know with any amount of exactness what kind of shifting would go on, but certainly there would be shifting.
And, Mr. Hagan, we really don't know what the value across the state is of these kind of properties then?
Mr. Chair, I certainly don't. I don't know. I don't believe we could find that out.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Hagan?
Senator Ortman has an amendment.
Yep, Senator Ortman has an amendment on the front of the committee. Any discussion? Senator Chaudhry, Mr. Forrester,
on the amendment? Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, will this help you support the bill? Be able to support it after this amendment?
Senator Ortman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's a fair question to find out what the impact is first, but there's no way I'll support it without the amendment.
Well, maybe we should find out the impact before we do the amendment.
Mr. Chair, maybe we should find out the impact before you presented the bill, but we don't have that.
Senator Schreiner.
I'd urge you to vote no on the amendment.
Chair, can I just...
Senator,
does it read, the property is the homestead of the owner? Is that what we end up with?
That's pretty much what we end up with. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Amendment is not approved.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
how do we get at this this shifting issue? How do we get some more concrete numbers on it?
Senator Chaudhry, I guess we'll have to try to work with the department to see if we can come up with some kind of ideas and what the values are and how many properties might qualify. And there will be certainly be a percentage of owners that won't apply, and we'd have to come up with all that to figure it out. I don't have an answer to it.
We'll pursue that. I mean, we're not interested in creating a significant burden elsewhere, but I mean, if we're talking about pennies statewide, that's different.
No,
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, we're talking about tens of millions statewide. Statewide there is a lot of shifting with this. I think maybe Mr. Forrester, the thing to do is maybe try take some governmental unit, whether it's your township or some other one in Lake Country, and try to identify, at least in one taxing jurisdiction, how much shifting. We then would have some kind of a sample case, at least, in Lake Country, of how much shifting would happen in some township around Brainerd or around Vermilion or around Ely or somewhere.
Chairman Scully and Senator Bach, we'll work on that for Vermilion. It seems like a good case study. I do know that the average, as I said in my testimony, the average shoreline ownership is 137 feet. So most owners of shoreline would not qualify for this, and there would be a significant portion that wouldn't enroll for whatever reason. They don't want to tie it up, or, you know, people tend not to act. You know, I'm always amazed at how few people use the Sustainable Forestry Initiative. It's inconceivable to me, but very few do. And same with conservation easements. Very few use the conservation easement, but it's out there. And so it's hard to guess, but maybe we should look at Lake Vermilion and see like how it would affect Brighting.
Well, and Mr. Forrester, to my thoughts on this, if you're in a pretty fully developed lake, gull, or I can pick a lake, there's not going to be much of this property left. It's already all developed. What you're trying to get at, I would guess, is probably a more remote lakes, lakes that haven't had the development pressure and still have edges or ends that probably a little harder to access, a little harder to develop, that aren't developed. That's, I would assume, what you're targeting.
Exactly.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bach.
There is more of this than people think. I know an individual on the range who owns a 25-acre lake. He owns the entire lake because it falls within his 40. You know, and he probably would love to have this bill, but he has no intentions of selling any of that lake because he has his own private little lake, and it's probably worth a lot more in the long run for resale than if he actually subdivided it. But I can only imagine the tax break he would get. And I mean, the guy's a good friend. His wife gives me tomatoes every fall. You know, but there's a Senator Chaudhry, there's a lot more of this than you think in Lake Country.
Well, let's take a look and see if we can get some idea of what is out there and what the shifts would be, and maybe take Senator Bach's suggestion and pick a jurisdiction, take a look at what it is, maybe in Cass County, or, you know, that's kind of center of the state. They've got a lot of lakes and a lot of development pressure. Let's see what we can figure out. So, Senator Chaudhry, without objection, we will lay Senate File 1420 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Sure.
Welcome to the Property Tax Division, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm here to present Senate File 1021. This is a bill relating to taxation, increasing the maximum homeowners' property tax refunds. During this past election, as I was going door to door in our rural district, I heard a deep concern about how, with increasing market values and also shifts onto to local property taxes that occurred as a result of a number of phenomena, including the cuts to LGA and cuts to school funding, that their property taxes were increasing significantly and out of pace with their earned income. Many had not had done significant planning in their homes for incremental increases in property taxes, but had not had significant increases in their income to match with the significant increases that were occurring in local property taxes. Because their incomes had not grown or their incomes were fixed, they talked about being forced to sell or leave their homes well before they'd planned to, having planned to stay in their homes until they were no longer able to live independently. This bill increases the maximum property tax refund to homeowners through a system that increases or decreases property taxes based on income. It gives direct property tax relief directly to the homeowner and not through another group or entity. The maximum refund by income would be increased and adjusted for inflation. And the numbers that you see in the bill are based on the governor's budget. But, of course, it is my hope that those can be changed, maybe increased, at the discretion of this division should the dollars be available.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. And this certainly is a good effort and an effort that the division is looking hard at, where we can give property tax relief directly to the homeowner, as you said, and it is income-based. So we'll certainly be looking to see what we can do. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sharon, with all sincerity, this is one of the better bills that this committee has seen this session. I mean, this, you know, we all talk about local government aid and how important it is and getting money to counties, how important it is. But the truth is this gets money directly to property taxpayers whose property taxes are high in relation to their income. And my only criticism would be is it doesn't spend enough money. And I understand this is, if it's not the governor's program, it's very close to it. And Senator Sharon, I hope that as we put this property tax article together in the next few days, that we can incorporate your changes and enhance the program even further to provide additional property tax relief for people who are suffering from property taxes that are going up much faster than their personal incomes are. So thank you for bringing this in front of the committee.
Thank you. Senator Sharon?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, thank you very much for that, the support that you're giving to this and your encouragement to me to move this forward. I think that we all understand the essential value of this particular approach is that it gives a direct relief to the to the homeowner and that it really relates to the person's ability to pay affordability. And it has as its outcome the possibility of people staying in their homes longer and not moving into really expensive living situations for the state, especially for the elderly.
And Senator Bach, I think Senator Sharon did say that this is the governor's proposal and that we're going to try to beef it up some.
Well, yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chairman. Yes, I'd like to emphasize that these are simply numbers that we placed in here. You know, they relate to the governor's budget, but our hopes are that these numbers can be increased as the division deliberates.
Well, Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, maybe somebody from the department can tell me, but I thought in the governor's budget we were tracking about $8.5 million for the circuit breaker program, and I noticed the fiscal note on this says 9.1. It seems we're a little bit off from where the governor's budget was. That was my reason for kind of questioning if this really was the governor's program. Or, Mr. Manson, do you know? Didn't the governor's budget have $8.5 million for this program in it? Or is it really 9.1 as the department suggests?
Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, I have the original revenue analysis from the governor's tax bill, and he was at 8.5.
It's 9.1 in 2009.
Ms. Van.
Mr. Chair, members, Alexandra brought the our EBO from finance just informed me that this has been adjusted for the February forecast. So it some of the things that were in the governor's proposal have been increased in price for the February forecast, and this is one of them.
Okay, thank you.
So, Ms. Von Marsh, does that mean the February forecast indicated the property taxes are going to continue to rise? That's why this costs more?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, I'm looking at Alexandra to see if I can get a nod from her head. I am not sure exactly what the assumption would be behind that.
Mr. Manson, Senator wouldn't that be the assumption if this same program costs more money than in the February forecast we were recognizing higher property taxes? Wouldn't that be the assumption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, that would be my assumption at first glance as well.
Mr. Chair, some additional information. There's an assumption of a higher number of participants in the program.
So more people qualifying, or because we've had more outreach, and do we know why?
I think both.
Okay. Thank you.
Well taken.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Manson. Well, thank you, Senator Sharon. And any more questions, members? Without objection, we will lay Senate File 1021 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Senator. Senator Coring. Senator Coring, when you said good morning to me and that you would see me shortly, I thought you were going to be here at 8:30.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for that. I did not know this bill was up, and I had to call in the troops here to help me with this bill. First of all, I want to thank the committee for hearing this bill, and I'm immediately going to turn it over to my good friend, newly elected Representative Doty, who has been a senior advocate in my district for the last 6 years, and this is his idea, and he can explain the program very easily. So I would turn that over to him if that's okay.
Well, Senator Coring, we're glad to see Representative Doty here, and we will hear from the representative, but the Senate rules are...
Then I'll explain the bill. What it is, Mr. Chairman, is a deferral program that actually is in existence now for seniors 65 years of age and older. And there's only 127 participants in this program now. And what it does, it defers their property taxes. If they are in a situation where they can't afford to pay their property taxes, what it will do is it'll defer those property taxes, and it puts a lien on their property. And then when they pass away, that will in turn be paid. And there is interest accrued on that, if I'm not mistaken now. And what this language does, it gets rid of the interest so that there's no interest applied to that. What it does also is, if it's a married couple, only one of the couple needs to be 65 years old. You don't have to have both of them be 65 years old to be able to apply for this program. And so... it's pretty straightforward, I think. You've got a fiscal analysis from the Minnesota Department of Revenue on this, and I think it kind of explains it very well, I think.
Well, Senator Coring, we certainly... I'm looking at your bill and understanding this is an effort to try to get this to become a more utilized program, because we hear all the time about people who are concerned about being... taxed out of their homes,
right?
And if this mechanism is in place, why don't we let Representative Doty
He's
over here. Let's hear what's on his mind today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. For the 6 years previous to my election, I was senior advocate in Morrison and Crow Wing counties, and among the things that I dealt with was the property tax deferral program. It's a very little known, very little utilized program. It was never designed to be more than a little utilized program. It's kind of a niche for people who, for whatever reasons, are not covered by Medicare or insurance and would have a financial disaster, usually medical. The only couple of occasions that I sent people to this particular program were exactly that. One of the couple ended up with cancer, had an experimental drug program that was not covered, extremely expensive, and under this program, if the conditions are met, they are able then to defer the taxes with a lien on the property until after they have both passed away. Given that they have to prove they do not have mortgage in excess of this amount, given the fact that they have to encumber their property with a lien, this is not something that every senior citizen is going to just run out and put off their taxes. It will never be a way to avoid or prevent your taxes. The problems that came up with this, the purpose for this bill is to change three things, and that's the only three things that will change. Number one, as the senator mentioned, we have, under the current law, both members of a couple that own the property have to be over 65. This would change that to either one of them. The second change is to get rid of the interest. Currently, they are charged a 5% interest that would accrue. The feeling is these people are not doing this for fun. These people are doing this for necessity. Don't punish them any extra. And the third change is instead of an actual dollar amount, which is currently $60,000 income maximum in the law, this would change it so we don't have to go back, revisit the law all the time, and simply refer to whatever the number was on the property tax relief form from the previous year for the maximum for that. So it changes the static $60,000 to whatever the number was on the bottom of the table on the previous year's property tax relief form. All other provisions of the bill, of the law, would remain unchanged.
And, Representative, in your 6 years prior to being elected efforts here, I mean, I understand that part of the reason that people are hesitant to use this program is they don't want to, it's like they're taking on more responsibilities against their assets. Do you think that these three changes will increase utilization? I mean, is this? I'm sure that's the purpose of it, but in practicality, are these issues that people have brought up to you?
Mr. Chairman, Senators, yes, there will be a few more people that will use this. In my opinion, there will be a few more people that will use this program. I actually did encounter one couple that could not use this because the spouse that had the actual illness was not 65.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Doty, if we eliminate the interest provision, why wouldn't every senior that qualifies who is savvy, financially savvy, just not pay their property taxes, enroll it, and take their property tax bill for the year and put it into tax-free municipal bonds or something? Why would any senior that qualifies for this pay property taxes? I mean, you could take your property taxes and just throw it into municipal bonds, tax-free for the 10, 20 years, whatever you're going to live past retirement age. And then, I mean, someday the kids will, when you turn the property over, pay the property taxes, and you've had all those tax-deferred investments for all those years. Just seems like we're going in an odd direction by eliminating the interest.
Senator Corn?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that it's in statute now, and it's just a way to help people that are in a very awkward, very difficult situation. And I guess I'm relying on Representative Doty's knowledge and expertise of being a senior advocate and working with people in Morrison, Crow Wing County, and seeing what their needs are. And I'm going by his best judgment that this is something that's needed. And so I don't think there's going to be a mad rush. I don't believe that for one second. But there again, it could be. I don't know.
Representative Doty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I can't, based on my personal opinion, see that will happen for at least three reasons. Number one, the program has been around a long time with the 5% intact, and we have, I believe, 127 or some very small number like that in the whole state that use it. Number two, one of the things you have to do when you apply to the Commissioner of Revenue for this is prove that you do not have mortgage amounts in excess of the amount you're going to be paying back. That then becomes public knowledge. And number three, you have to encumber your property with a lien. For people to go through that much hassle, put that much of their life out in public for other people for 5%, I don't deem very likely to happen. I have never seen, I've only seen 3-4 of the people that are out of those 127, but I have never seen anyone that did it for any reason except a medical emergency.
Any more questions, members? Well, thank you, Senator Coring. And without objection, we will lay Senate File 1290 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Senator Moore.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
It's just not a very good
Thanks.
Idea.
We've done Scrogan. But Olson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you Senate File 1258. It's a pretty simple bill. It addresses a very a simple concept that looks complex on paper. But I'm glad to be able to present this to you. The 2003 LGA reforms caused cities, LGAs, to swing up and down more from year to year, and from the end of the session estimates to the final certification on August the 1st. This has made LGA less predictable and budgeting very difficult for cities. The League of Minnesota Cities convened a working group that included the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, the Metro Cities Group, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, House and Senate staff, and the Department of Revenue staff. All the city organizations, various city organizations out there are supportive of this bill, as well as the Department of Revenue. So what does the bill do? The bill makes two changes to how the formula works. Each year, half of the formula aid will be distributed based on the most current data, and half will be distributed based on the previous year's data. For 2008 only, this is accomplished by giving each city half of the formula aid it received in 2007, then dividing the other half of the appropriation using the new data. For 2009 and beyond, this is accomplished by giving each city all of its formula aid from the previous year, then dividing the other half of the appropriation using the newest data. There's a chart in your packet that Mr. Willett is going to walk through that shows how this works. The second change in the bill is a change that will add a provision whereby no city's LGA can decrease more than $15 per capita in any given year. And this is in addition to the existing limits on decreases in current law. This will give all cities a common maximum budget hit from LGA decreases. Mr. Chair, members, this bill does not change the formula distribution, but rather it smooths out the peaks and valleys to make budgeting easier for cities. Examples of how it would impact a few cities are included in the packet. Again, Mr. Willett will walk us through. This bill is good for cities and for the LGA program, whether or not the legislature decides to make other changes to the LGA program this year. We have heard loud and clear, Mr. Chair, members, whether it is from small cities or metro cities, cities are asking that we help them, and I think the one area that I've heard loud and clear being a member of this committee is the volatility of it makes it very difficult. And so I hope you will give this bill some consideration, and I have Mr. Willett here who will walk through the packet with us.
Mr. Willett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Willett. I'm a policy analyst with the League of Minnesota Cities. And what's being passed out is a rather lengthy description of how this bill works, and I won't go through it in great detail. Senator Moat gave you a good overview. I do want to call your attention to the chart on the top of the second page, which sort of illustrates how this 50-50 formula thing would work. Under current law, 456 million of the $486 million LGA appropriation is distributed each year through a formula that uses updated data every year. And as Senator Moa said, it's this data and the changes that were made in 2003 that have made cities' appropriations for LGA go up and down in a very unpredictable manner. So under current law, it's new data every year. And basically what we're doing with this bill is saying that for each year, we're going to hold back half the impact of formula changes by 1 year. So if you look at the graph, for 2008, half of the formula dollars would be based on the 2007 formula data, and cities already know what that is for their city. And then the other half would be based on the new data. Then the following year, you would carry forward so that half of that data would be based on 2008, and the other half would be based on the new data. So whatever impact up or down a city's experiencing because of changes in their city's data, half of that impact would be delayed by 1 year. So it basically has the impact of cutting the volatility in half. Individual city charts on the following pages show how this would work for a particular city. The lighter colored bar is, this is a simulation I did using the data from 2004 through 2007. The lighter colored bars are how it works under current law, and the darker bars is how it would work applying this new 50-50 split. And what you'll see with the West St. Paul example is that when West St. Paul is on the downside would be about half as bad. When they're on the upside, similarly, they wouldn't go up quite as far. So over the course of a number of years, the total number of dollars going into the city would be same, but the peaks and valleys would be smoothed out.
Mr. Ouellette, this really is just a two-year averaging of your aid, and other than the cap change that you have in here for the $15 per capita, and I haven't really looked at if that has a significant impact or not, there would be no impact to a city's what they're going to receive in total dollars over a given number of years. It's just that they're going to run on a two-year average instead of a one-year.
That's right, Mr. Chair. It would have a negligible impact. Regarding the $15 per capita floor, we did take a close look at that because when we spoke with you individually, you raised some concern that that might delay how long it takes some cities to get to their formula amount. And under the we can't predict the future and what cities' formula is going to do, but under that, the current data that we have, there were only about six cities of the 850 cities that had more than a one-year increase in how long it would take them to get their full funding. So from our perspective, that's a pretty modest impact to help achieve this kind of stability in the program.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ouellette. Questions, members? Senator Waugh?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, while I'm hopeful and optimistic that we will do something with respect to LGA, regardless of the outcome, this is the least that we could do to try to give cities some predictability and stability in terms of the outlook in LGA.
Very good, Senator Ma. With no more questions, anybody else want to speak on this? Thank you. With that, we will lay Senate File 1258 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. And we're not going to do that. Members, we did a lot of work today. We got through all the bills that the committee currently has, except Senator Olson wasn't able to be here. So we really don't know if we're going to meet on Wednesday or not right now. Currently, I think we won't meet on Wednesday unless we get notice to you by tomorrow. So we'll leave it at there, and committee's adjourned.